ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I would have liked to continue to carry on those skills and teachings, but in doing so, I'm putting my sons and my nephews at risk of going to jail. It takes away my identity as a strong Aboriginal man.
Native title holders on the New South Wales south coast are taking their legal battle to a new front after fighting for cultural fishing rights in the local courts for decades. Today, they filed a class action in the federal court, which could result in compensation payouts. That story soon. And shortly, we'll head over to WA's so-called Electric Highway, where the work on the network of charging stations from Kununurra to Esperance has passed the halfway mark.
We want visitors to these towns in regional WA to be able to come and visit, plug in their electric car, charge it up in about an hour or so, and during that hour they can visit town, they can buy a postcard, get a coffee, grab some souvenirs, have a look around at the sites.
I'm Alex Simon and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. Today represents a landmark in the long-running legal battle over cultural fishing rights on the south coast of New South Wales. Native title holders are filing a class action in the federal court against the New South Wales state government for continuing prosecution of traditional fishing practices that are protected under Commonwealth native title law. Bega reporter Vanessa Milton has been following this issue.
For decades, the waters of the New South Wales south coast have been a battleground, with native title holders facing prosecution for their traditional fishing practices, which come into conflict with the state's fisheries management regulations. Steve Clark, a Bidjigal Wadi Wadi Wandian man from Nowra, south of Sydney, says the fear of fines and jail time mean that he feels forced to give up on a tradition that goes back thousands of years.
I would have liked to continue to carry on those skills and teachings, but in doing so, I'm putting my sons and my nephews at risk of going to jail. It takes away my identity as a strong Aboriginal man.
Steve was taught to dive for abalone and lobster by his uncles as a child. As the eldest in his family, it was his cultural responsibility to provide for his extended family. By the time he reached his teens, Steve was being stopped and searched by fisheries compliance officers.
From then on, I was pretty much targeted. Every time I went to the beach or rocks or anywhere, they'd be there.
Steve is now 53. He gave up diving in his late 20s after being fined thousands of dollars and serving jail time over unpaid fishing fines.
It doesn't feel good. You know, it's like you're letting them down, you know, and you're letting yourself down, and then you can't provide, and you know, you really want to, but you can't, you know, without taking that risk of getting caught or going to jail. You know, when we go and get something, we provide for not only ourselves, but our family and our extended families, you know, like, that's how it is.
After decades fighting costly battles over cultural fishing rights in local courts, native title holders on the New South Wales south coast are now taking their legal battle to a new front. Today they will file a class action in the federal court, which could see over 10,000 people eligible for a compensation payout from the New South Wales government for the continuing prosecution of traditional fishing practices. They claim the state government's failure to recognise the native title rights of Aboriginal fishers is in breach of the Racial Discrimination Act and has had a devastating impact on health, family cohesion and the handing down of saltwater cultural practices across generations.
We believe that people deserve to be compensated and acknowledged for the wrongs of the past. A lot of people have expressed to us that these kind of prosecutions are having a real chilling effect on the practice of cultural fishing on the south coast. We're hearing consistently that a lot of people are just too afraid to get in the water.
That's Solicitor Tristan Gavin, who is acting for the claim group, which includes over 10,000 Aboriginal people on the New South Wales south coast. He has been involved in stolen wages and stolen generations class actions that have won hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation for Aboriginal communities. This legal action comes after a series of cases brought by the New South Wales government against Aboriginal fishers have been dismissed or withdrawn in local courts.
These are very long, difficult expensive proceedings. There's a lot of wear and tear, not only on the South Coast community, but also on the fishery compliance officers that are involved.
That's Solicitor Catherine Ridge, who has successfully defended 14 South Coast native title holders facing prosecution over fishing matters. She believes the local courts are not the right place to test native title holders' rights.
The problem is at a much higher level, and I think the class action is better placed to deal with that injustice.
The class action is likely to take years to be resolved in court. But for Steve Clark, it is a chance to restore his culture and identity.
We are very resilient people. We're still here. But we're not going nowhere. We just have to keep fighting the fight and standing up for our rights and our future generation.
Vanessa Milton with that story. And in a statement, a spokesperson for the New South Wales Minister for Agriculture said that these matters are complex socially and legally, and the New South Wales government is working its way through them to ensure any regulation and enforcement balances the needs of fish conservation, cultural sensitivities and community needs.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
To WA now, where the recent death of a volunteer firefighter who was battling a blaze on the state's south coast has raised concerns among local governments that under new workplace health and safety laws, council and shire CEOs could get charged with industrial manslaughter. Our reporter in Esperance is Emily Smith, and she's been following this story. Emily, firstly, can you explain the change in WA's workplace health and safety laws that's led to these concerns from councils and shires?
Hi, Alex. WA's Workplace Health and Safety Act was updated and changes came into effect in 2022, which for the first time included the crime of industrial manslaughter within those laws. So these carry really high penalties. And under the new legislation, it sort of means that shires and shire CEOs are responsible. They have a health and safety duty of care for volunteer bushfires. So given this recent tragedy, there have been a lot of questions asked about how these changes will play out.
Emily, can you tell us the story of Harry Stead, the volunteer bushfire fighter I made mention of in my introduction?
Harry Stead was a young volunteer firefighter who died while responding to a fire on Boxing Day, just west of Esperance. And as I said, following that, it's really raised questions about liability given these new workplace health and safety laws and what this could mean for the local shire and its CEO.
And how would the new laws work in that case?
We don't really know yet because they are so new, but the Acting WorkSafe Commissioner has confirmed that yes, a shire CEO could be held personally responsible in theory. That's because volunteers are given the same workplace health and safety protections as employees, and under the law, shire CEOs will likely be seen as the one with the duty of care to these volunteers. But she also said that in regards to this specific case, it's very unhelpful to speculate at this early stage. And that's really premature given the investigation is ongoing.
So then how realistic is it that someone would be charged, and how much, as you mentioned there, is theoretical?
I would say it is very much theoretical at the moment. One thing the WorkSafe Commissioner really highlighted was that any prosecution will have to be deemed to be in the public interest. And given we're dealing with volunteer firefighters here that play a very critical role in this part of the world where there's a lot of fires, there's barely any paid firefighters, that could have a lot of influence, I would say. But the WorkSafe investigation into this is ongoing, so we really won't know until that's finalised. In saying that, a group of councils from around this area have raised concerns about the possibility of the shire CEO being held responsible and have indicated that they don't think that that would be fair.
So what concerns then have the shires expressed about the potential knock-on effect of the new legislation should it go down that path?
So local governments in the Goldfields area, they've expressed concern about whether it's fair to put this level of responsibility onto a shire CEO. In this part of the world, volunteer firefighters will at times just go and respond to a bushfire without even getting direction from the local government. Local government also doesn't have technical expertise when it comes to fire in the way that the Department of Fire and Emergency Services, the State Department would, for example. So they really don't think it's appropriate that they be burdened with this liability, especially because all they're trying to do in coordinating volunteer fire brigades is to keep the rest of the community safe.
So have any shires suggested that they may actually change their volunteer bushfire fighting operations as a result of these laws?
That they have in a way. I spoke to one CEO, Peter Fitchard, who is the CEO of the Shire of Dundas, which covers a huge area geographically from Norseman, which is 2 hours south of Kalgoorlie, all the way to the South Australian border. But it has a very small rate space. It doesn't have many resources. And he said this liability issue is part of the reason that he doesn't want to send volunteers to fires. He wants to instead just hand control over to the State Department at the early opportunity. He is in a unique position, though, where there's very few firefighters in that area. It could play out very differently in a place like Esperance, where you have heaps of volunteer firefighters. The other thing another member of this Goldfields Voluntary Organisation of Council said was that this could really have a chilling effect on the recruitment of CEOs, which can be quite difficult into remote places anyway. So that they have raised those as concerns.
Why was the legislative safety framework updated to include the crime of industrial manslaughter?
Well, industrial manslaughter carries really high consequences. So the maximum penalty for an individual is 20 years in prison or a $5 million fine. So the state government's hoping that's going to have a really strong deterrence effect to stop managers sending workers or volunteers into unsafe situations. I did speak to a lawyer based here in WA named Greg Smith, who also says there's a growing public expectation that bosses will be held more accountable for this sort of thing. And he says that that may see more CEOs and the heads of organisations prosecuted in this way.
When we look at the history of the prosecution of company officers in Australia, almost universally, they involve prosecutions of small business owners who are close to the day-to-day performance of the work. And I think there is an appetite amongst regulators to try and lift that level of accountability higher up into larger organisations. So I think it is a matter of time before we start to see executive officers well removed from frontline work being potentially or certainly investigated and potentially prosecuted.
And what's driving that?
Well, I think it is the public expectation that's been created by the national acceptance of this idea of industrial manslaughter.
But he also points out that these prosecutions would have been possible under old laws, most likely. It's just that the consequences weren't as severe. And historically, there have been very few CEOs prosecuted.
So finally, Emily, what does the Workplace Commissioner say about all of this?
Well, they haven't said a whole lot because of the ongoing investigation. The Acting WorkSafe Commissioner says that, yes, theoretically, it is possible that a CEO could be charged, but only if all elements of WorkSafe's prosecution policy are met. As I said, they highlighted public interest as a really big part of that. So I guess we'll basically wait and see how this plays out.
Our reporter down on the south coast of WA is Emily Smith. Emily, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide once again.
Thank you.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Work on WA's so-called Electric Highway, a network of charging stations spanning from Esperance in the state south to Kununurra in the far north, has passed the halfway mark. The government-owned utility Synergy has just commissioned a new fast charging station for electric vehicles in Kalgoorlie-Boulder at the Lord Forest Precinct on Cassidy Street. It represents the 27th location so far, with the $24 million project to comprise 49 locations once it's completed later this year. Goldfields reporter Jared Lucas has this story.
Yeah.
Plugging it in.
Yeah.
The thing is, everyone wants to sort of hold it like you do at the petrol station.
Power,
you don't need to hold it.
Sure. It's always the rookie mistake where always the pictures you have your hand on it.
We're at a press conference for the commissioning of Kalgoorlie-Boulder's new fast charging station, and it's time to pose for the cameras next to Rob Sterry's bright red Tesla electric vehicle.
Being able to charge in an hour rather than before you were looking at 10 to 12 hours.
Wow.
So if you drove into town,
say
from Perth or whatever, you'd have to put your car on charge for 10 to 12 hours to get it up to full, whereas this will do it in an hour.
Rob Sterry and his wife Kylie have owned their electric vehicle for the past 5 years. In that time, they've made numerous trips to Perth, a 600-kilometre journey from their Kalgoorlie home, and they've always suffered from what's known as range anxiety. To electric vehicle owners, that's the distance between their next charging station.
It was interesting having to stop in Meriden for a couple of hours and Southern Cross on your way to Perth and back, but you soon adjust to it.
What do you reckon a trip is to Perth now?
6.5, 7 hours, so probably about the same time if you have kids in the car and you've got to stop. But it'll just allows much easier now to do it.
So what you wait, it was a 10-hour job to get to Perth before?
Yeah, about 9.5 hours.
Yeah, 9.5 hours. So this makes it a much more convenient thing, isn't it?
Excellent. It makes it really, really well worth it. Bit of luxury.
It's a 150 kilowatt fast charger. You can charge your electric vehicle from about 20% to 80% in about half an hour. It's going to cost you about $30 to charge your electric car, and that'll get you, for one of these electric cars behind me here, a range of about 400 or so kilometres.
Kalgoorlie Boulder is the 27th location so far on the state government's so-called electric highway. Once complete, it'll extend from Esperance in WA's south to Kununurra in the state's far north, as well as Eucla on the South Australian border.
And each of the charging stations in this network is only separated by about 200 kilometres. We've done that very deliberately because we want visitors to these towns in regional WA to be able to come and visit, plug in their electric car, charge it up in about an hour or so, and during that hour they can visit town, they can buy a postcard, get a coffee, grab some souvenirs, have a look around at the sites before moving along to the next location.
The state Labor member for Kalgoorlie, Ali Kent, says she hopes that the fast charger helps improve tourism.
I believe it's the longest network in the world. It's a wonderful thing for us to be on this network. We've been waiting for this fast charger and now we've got it. So bring on more Teslas for the town. And I'm told that it's also going to bring a lot of tourists to town because they know there'll be a fast charging point here. They all know where those points are. So we look forward to getting more tourists in town as well.
The city of Kalgoorlie-Boulder was one of the more progressive councils in Western Australia. It set up a slow charger on the city's main street back in 2017, and that same year the council bought its own electric vehicle. Kalgoorlie-Boulder Mayor Glenn Wilson.
That is well used within our environment teams within the city. You'll often see it parked out the front of our charging station for the City of Kalgoorlie-Boulder, which is in our admin building on Hannon Street, but also utilised by our staff Monday to Friday.
Many of the minerals which are found in the batteries which power electric vehicles are mined in WA's goldfields, including lithium, cobalt and nickel. Nickel has traditionally been used in stainless steel, and it boomed during the 1960s and 70s. But this year has seen the emergence of cheaper nickel coming out of Indonesia, resulting in hundreds of job losses across the WA nickel sector. The biggest blow could be yet to come, with mining giant BHP considering placing its Nickel West division on care and maintenance, and that employs more than 3,000 workers across WA, including more than 300 at the Kalgoorlie nickel smelter.
I'd like to see some stability in nickel, that'd be good, but also that would provide a lot more of an opportunity for the battery market as well. There's a lot of support for the metals industry around the city and to see potentially some of these deals that are done between the mining companies and the car providers with those minerals that are mined close to the city of Kalgoorlie-Boulder, we'd love to see more of that.
Synergy's Jason Froud says he expects the uptake of electric vehicles to increase to the point where every traditional petrol station has its own fast charger.
The intention with the state government helping to fund this program is to kick it off effectively and show that it can be done and incentivise EV uptake in the state. And I think what you'll find, we've got about nearly 20,000 EVs in Western Australia now. It's growing quickly. As that number grows, you will find in time that local petrol stations, your typical petrol stations around town, will start to put in their own charging stations as well. And it will slowly evolve. So by the state government helping to fund this, it's giving it a kickstart. It's not intended to be doing it all for all eternity, but we are providing a network such that you can drive around the entirety of the state really with an electric vehicle if you need to. We're showing it can be done.
I've talked to service station owners previously and they've said it is cost prohibitive for them to go down the road of putting in their own charging stations at this stage. Is that the view largely held, do you feel, at the moment, that it's still cost prohibitive?
It's only cost prohibitive because the revenue's not quite there yet. As I said, you know, when we find the number of EVs in the state going up north of, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100,000 EVs, all of a sudden the number of charging events on the network goes up exponentially, and then the revenue will start to, you know, offset the costs. So that will come in time.
That's electric vehicle owner Rob Sterry ending that report from Jared Lucas in WA's Goldfields after the commissioning of Kalgoorlie-Boulder's new fast charging station. And the next phase of work on WA's electric highway is set to tackle the Nullarbor, with fast chargers to be installed along the Eyre Highway out to the South Australian border at Eucla. And finally here on Australia Wide, a rare and precious opal discovery near the tiny town of Yawa in southwest Queensland will be kept in Australia after being acquired by Geoscience Australia. Dave Darby discovered the Yawa Moon Opal in 2020 at Brandy Gully, a mine site just near Yawa. Danielle Lancaster brings us this story.
It started as just another day for Dave Darby at his open mine Brandy Gully on the outskirts of Yawa, more than 10 hours west of Brisbane. Dave's father and mother first took over the site in 1970, searching for the elusive and rare Yawa Nut Opal, the year Dave was born. Yawa nuts are only found in this arid part of western Queensland. As the name suggests, the opal is the shape of a roundish nut and encased by ironstone. In October 2020, Dave made a once-in-a-lifetime discovery. He realised he was onto something special when he picked up a rock that felt a little heavier than any other he'd collected.
Well, we've thought, I want a bit of a colour there first, and then it just, as more as I dug in, more and more nuts came with, and most of the nuts were carrying colour, probably 8 out of 10 nuts were making colour. So we took them home, sort of put them all through the saw then and sliced them up. And when I first felt the nut, it was really heavy, and so I said, oh, it could be something in here, you know, it could be just solid ironstone. But as I sliced it and peeled it apart, it was just like an ocean of, blue-green and all the other colours that were in it. A bit of reds and pinks and all that, and purples. And, I was just in shock, really. I really didn't believe, all that night. I just couldn't stop looking at it.
David discovered what he's since named the Yawa Moon Opal for its round shape and milky colour in the centre of the nut. He said the precious stone reminded him of the spectacular full moon seen in the sky above Yawa. The team from Geoscience Australia, which hosts the Australian National Mineral and Fossil Collection in Canberra, immediately realised its importance. Dr. Steve Hill, chief scientist at Geoscience Australia, said he was speechless when he first saw the opal.
The thing that's incredible about it is the quality of opal that we're looking at here and the colours of that sample. That in itself just engrosses you, and that's amazing. But what's also incredible about this is it's such a beautiful example of a Yawa nut, which is the term that's used for these samples that look like, they basically look like a nut, but they've got that precious opal inside. But I love the way it's got that ironstone casing, that really dark red-brown rock that encloses the sample. And that just, that really sets my imagination alight, because you think, how many red-brown rocks are there around? And yet this one they've opened up and it's hosting this beautiful sample. And it's really a great contrast between the really dark red-brown of the casing with that really bright rainbow colours of the opal on the inside.
Geoscience Australia bought the precious stone from Dave with funds from the National Cultural Heritage Account. It is now housed in the Rocks That Shape Australia collection in Canberra. The centre has several opal samples, Australia's national gemstone, but Dr. Hill says nothing compared to the incredible quality of the Yawa Moon opal.
A sample of the quality of the Yawa Moon sample is really important to us. We do have a number of opal samples, but nothing of this incredible quality, and that tells such a great story. So for us, that was important. But then it's also our role in safeguarding that sample for Australia and to ensure that it stays in Australia and can be seen by all Australians is then the further important part to why we have that sample here.
Dave's wish for the opal never to leave Australia and to belong to the people of Australia has become true. Dave is back mining on Brandy Gully and says he'll keep on going for another 10 years or so, searching for another elusive Yawa nut, just like the Yawa Moon.
No, this would be a very special moment in my life that, this Yawa nut is going to a good place, and which would be its home for the rest of its life. No, it'd be really amazing to sort of, for the whole journey.
That report from Danielle Lancaster about the Yawa Moon Opal with miner Dave Darby and the Chief Scientist at Geoscience Australia, Dr. Steve Hill. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.